and lovingly as ever. "Please pity me," he would screech in his husky, piping tones. "Kill me! Crush me! Let it all end, I beg!" But she could no longer understand him. All she heard were husky cheeps and chirps. Inside, however, she guessed well enough what he was trying to say. Eos may not have had the ability to grant immortality or eternal youth, but she was gifted with enough divine power to do something to end her beloved's misery. One evening, when she felt neither of them could take any more, she closed her eyes, concentrated hard, and watched through hot tears as Tithonus's poor, shrunken body made the very few changes necessary to turn him from a withered old man into a grasshopper. A cicada, in some versions. I was always taught a grasshopper, perhaps because they are commonly found in Britain. Books for British children probably thought a cicada would be a harder insect for us to visualize. Oddly, Tithonus' name lives on biologically, not as a cicada or grasshopper, but in a type of birdwing or swallowtail butterfly, Ornithoptera tithonus. In this new form of grasshopper, Tithonus hopped from the cold marble floor onto the ledge of the balcony before leaping out into the night. She saw him in her sister Selene's cold moonlight, clinging to a long blade of grass that swayed in the night breeze. His back legs scraped out a sound that might have been a grateful chirrup of loving farewell. Her tears fell, and somewhere, far away, Aphrodite laughed. A happy thought inspired the geologist Albert Oppel to name one of the late Jurassic ages the Tithonian, as a bow to Eos, for it is the age that marks the dawn of the Cretaceous. Alfred Lord Tennyson's Tithonus is one of his most loved and anthologized poems. It takes the form of a dramatic monologue addressed to Eos, in which he begs her to deliver him from his senility. "After many a summer dies the swan, me only cruel immortality consumes. I wither slowly in thine arms, here at the quiet limit of the world, a white-haired shadow roaming like a dream." It contains a famous line that might be considered one of the great themes of Greek myth. "The gods themselves cannot recall their gifts." The Bloom of Youth. The story of Eos and Tithonus can be considered a kind of domestic tragedy. Greek myth offers us many more stories of love between gods and mortals, which more often fit into the genre doomed romance, sometimes with an element of rom-com, farce, and horror thrown in. In these love affairs, the gods seem always to say it with flowers. The Greek for flower is anthos, so what follows is, quite literally, a romantic anthology. Hyacinthus. Hyacinthus, a beautiful Spartan prince, had the misfortune to be loved by two divinities, Zephyrus, the west wind, and golden Apollo. Hyacinth himself much preferred the beautiful Apollo, and repeatedly turned down the wind's playful but increasingly fierce advances. One afternoon, Apollo and Hyacinth were competing in athletic events, and Zephyrus, in a fit of jealous rage, blew Apollo's discus off course, sending it skimming at speed straight towards Hyacinth. It struck him hard on the forehead, killing him stone dead. In a flood of grief, Apollo refused Hermes the right to transport the youth's soul to Hades, instead mixing the mortal blood that gushed from his adored one's brow with his own divine and fragrant tears. This heady juice dropped into the soil, and from it bloomed the exquisite and sweet-smelling flower that bears Hyacinth's name to this day. Crocus and Smilax. Crocus was a mortal youth who pined without success for the nymph Smilax. Out of pity, the gods, we don't really know which one, turned him into the saffron flower that we call crocus, while she became a brambly vine, many species of which still flourish under the name Smilax. According to another version of this myth, Crocus was the lover and companion of the god Hermes, who accidentally killed him with a discus, and in his sorrow turned him into the crocus flower. This is so similar to the story of Apollo and Hyacinthus that you wonder if some bard somewhere got drunk or confused. Aphrodite and Adonis. Theas was an early king of Cyprus, renowned for his remarkable good looks. He and his wife, Cenchreis, had a daughter, Smyrna, also known as Myrrha or Myrrha, who grew up harbouring secret incestuous love for her handsome father. Now Cyprus was sacred to Aphrodite, being the island on which she first set foot after her birth from the foam of the sea. And it was a spiteful Aphrodite who had breathed into Smyrna this unnatural desire for her own father. It seems that the goddess had of late been aggrieved by the inadequacy of King Theus's prayers and sacrifices to her. He had displayed the temerity to open a new shrine dedicated to Dionysus, a cult which was proving popular amongst the islanders. Aphrodite regarded the neglect of her temples as the worst possible crime, far worse than incest. But in the minds of mortals, even those of the notoriously laissez-faire and decadent Cyprus, incest was a taboo of the gravest kind. An anguished Smyrna attempted to smother her guilty feelings. Aphrodite, who really seemed determined to sow mischief, hatched a plot with Smyrna's maid Hippolyte that would bring the whole business to a disturbing crisis. One evening, when Theus had got himself good and drunk, as he liked to do since his discovery of the vinous virtues of the god Dionysus, Hippolyte, under the spell of Aphrodite, led Smyrna to his chamber and into his bed. The king made greedy love to his daughter there, too intoxicated to question his good fortune. In the dark of night and the fog of wine, he failed to recognize the fruit of his own loins. He only knew that a young, desirable, and passionately obliging girl was appearing each night to pleasure him like some kind of divine succubus. After a week of these intense and joyful visitations, he awoke one morning with a determination to know more about her. He put out word that he would reward with a mountain of gold anyone who could discover the identity of the mysterious stranger who had lately made his nights so wildly pleasurable. Smyrna had been acting out her passion in a kind of mad dream of lust. But when she heard that all Cyprus was now trying to find out the secret of her nightly visits to Theus, she ran from the palace to hide in the woods. She wanted to die, but she could not forsake the child that she felt growing inside her. Railing at the laws of man that made her love criminal, she begged heaven to take pity on her. Human civilization has made spiteful laws, and what nature allows, the jealous laws forbid, is her complaint, according to Ovid in his Metamorphoses. In answer to her prayer, the gods transformed Smyrna into a weeping myrrh tree. After 10 months, the tree burst open and disgorged a mortal baby boy, Adonis. Naiads anointed the child with the soft tears that wept from the myrrh, a balm which remains the source of the most important birth and coronation oils to this very day. Adonis grew up to be a youth of the most unparalleled physical attractiveness. Oh dear, I've said this too many times for you to believe me again. It is true that all who looked upon him were smitten forever, and true also that his name lives on as a descriptor of paragons of male beauty. It is necessary for us at least to know that Adonis was lovely enough to attract, as no other mortal ever had, the one who had done so much to bring about his birth, the goddess of love and beauty herself, Aphrodite. They became lovers. It had been a wild and tortuous path to this coupling. The goddess, in a spirit of malicious revenge, had caused a father to commit a forbidden act with his daughter, which brought forth a child whom Aphrodite loved perhaps more completely than any other being. A lifetime of therapy could surely not clear up such a psychic mess as that. They did everything together, Adonis and Aphrodite. She knew that the other gods hated the boy. Demeter and Artemis could not bear to see so many girls sickening with love for him. Hera stonily disapproved of the issue of so shameful and flagrant an indecent affront to the sacred institutions of marriage and family, while Ares was stormily jealous of his lover's intense infatuation. Aphrodite sensed all this and determined to keep Adonis safe from the harm her resentful family might do him. Because her precious mortal lover, like most Greek boys and men, showed a great passion for hunting, the protective Aphrodite told him that while he was free to chase prey of manageable size and limited ferocity, hares, rabbits, doves, and pigeons, for example, he was absolutely forbidden from pursuing lions, bears, boars, and the larger stags. But boys will be boys, and when the girls are away, they cannot resist reverting to type and showing off. And so it came about that one afternoon Aphrodite's beloved found himself alone on the trail of a great boar. Some say the boar was actually Ares himself in disguise. Adonis cornered the beast and was just pulling back his spear ready for the kill when it turned on him with a savage roar, tusks bristling. Adonis dropped his spear in fright as he leapt back, but he was a brave young man and managed to steady himself and plant his feet firmly enough to meet the boar's charge. As it rushed forward, Adonis spun his body round in a graceful turn like a dancer, and Adonis seized it by the neck as it passed. But the boar was cunning. It dropped its head to the ground, letting the boy think he had subdued it. Kneeling down, Adonis pushed with one hand against the animal's head, feeling with his spare hand for the knife he kept in his belt. The boar sensed his chance and pulled his head up with a snarl, lifting and twisting his great tusks. They tore Adonis's stomach open, and he fell mortally wounded to the ground. Aphrodite arrived in time to see her lover bleeding to death, and the boar, or was it Ares, grunting in triumph as it galloped away deep into the forest. There was nothing the weeping goddess could do but hold Adonis and watch him choke out his last in her arms. From his blood and her tears sprang up bright red anemones, named after the anemoi, the winds that so quickly blow away the petals of this exquisitely lovely flower, which is known to be as short-lived as youth and as fragile as beauty. Shakespeare's long poem Venus and Adonis retells the myth, basing itself on the version Ovid tells in his Metamorphoses. In Shakespeare's version, the death of Adonis causes Venus to curse love and decree that henceforward it should always be tinged with tragedy. Sorrow on love hereafter shall attend, she prophesies in her grief. It shall be cause of war and dire events, and set dissension twixt the son and sire. They that love best, their loves shall not enjoy. A prophecy that seems to have come all too true. Echo and Narcissus. Tiresias. The best known of all the stories that involve the transformation of a youth into a flower begins with a worried mother taking her son to see a prophet. As well as the soothsayers and sibyls who spoke on behalf of the divine oracles, there existed certain select mortal beings whom the gods also privileged with the gift of prophecy. Arranging a consultation with one of these was not unlike making an appointment to see a doctor. The two most celebrated seers of Greek myth were Cassandra and Tiresias. Cassandra was a Trojan prophetess whose curse was to be entirely accurate in her prognostications, yet always just as entirely disbelieved. The Theban, Tiresias, underwent an equally stressed existence. Born male, he was turned female by Hera as a punishment for striking two mating snakes with a stick, something which annoyed her greatly at the time, for reasons best known to herself. After 7 years of serving Hera as a priestess, Tiresias was returned to his original male form, only to be struck blind by Athena for looking on her naked while she bathed in the river. Note the similarity of the offence to Actaeon's crime of spying on Artemis. The modesty of the gods while bathing was prodigious. T.S. Eliot makes memorable references in the Fire Sermon section of his poem The Wasteland. I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest, and I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all. That is one story that explains his blindness, but I prefer the variant that tells us how he was brought up to Olympus to arbitrate in a wager between Zeus and Hera. They had been arguing over which gender enjoyed sex the most. Since Tiresias, having been both male and female, was in a unique position to answer this question, it was agreed that his judgment would be final. Tiresias declared that in his experience, sex was 9 times more enjoyable for females than males. This enraged Hera, who had bet Zeus that men got the most pleasure from the act. Perhaps she was basing her opinion on the inexhaustible libido of her husband and her own more moderate sex drive. For his pains, Hera rewarded Tiresias by striking him blind. One god can never reverse the effects of another, so the best Zeus could do for Tiresias was to award him the compensatory faculty of second sight, the gift of prophecy. The honour of being asked to adjudicate amongst the gods might seem great for a mortal, but as this story shows, and as the Trojan prince Paris was to discover, the results could be catastrophic. Narcissus. The naiad Liriope coupled with the river god Cephisus, and gave birth to a son, Narcissus, whose beauty was so remarkable that she worried for his future. Liriope had seen enough of life to know that extreme beauty was an awful privilege, a dangerous attribute that could lead to dire and even fatal consequences. When Narcissus reached the age of 15 and started to attract unwanted attentions, she decided to act. "We are going to Thebes," she told him, "to see Tiresias and have your fortune told." And so mother and son walked for 2 weeks all the way to Thebes and joined the queue to see the prophet that formed every morning outside the temple of Hera. "Although you are blind and cannot see, my son," she explained to Tiresias when their turn came at last, "you may take my word for it that all who do see him are dazzled by his looks. No more beautiful mortal ever trod the earth." Narcissus blushed to his golden roots at this and shuffled his feet in an agony of embarrassment. "I know enough of the gods," continued Liriope, "to fear that such beauty might be more curse than blessing. The world knows what happened to Ganymede, to Adonis, Tithonus, Hyacinth, and to all those other boys far less beautiful than my son. So I would have you tell me, great seer, if Narcissus will live a long and happy life, is it his Moira to reach a contented old age?" The Moirai, you will remember, were the Fates. The Greeks felt that there was a personal, singular Moira that could be expressed as a mixture of an individual's fate, necessity, doom, justice and fortune, somewhere between luck and kismet. "You who are blind see all that is invisible to the rest of us. Tell me, I beg, my beloved son's destiny." Tiresias put out his hands and traced the outlines of Narcissus's face. "Fear not," he said. "So long as he fails to recognize himself, Narcissus will live a long and happy life." Liriope laughed aloud. "So long as he fails to recognize himself?" Such a strange pronouncement could have no serious application. How can anyone recognize themselves? Echo. We leave Liriope joyfully thanking Tiresias at the Temple of Hera in Thebes, and travel a short distance over to the foothills of Mount Helicon, where the streams and meadows outside the township of Thespiae were filled with the comeliest nymphs in all Greece. So comely that they often received visitations from Zeus himself, whose weakness for a comely nymph we have already noted. The Oread Echo was not the least comely of these, but she did have one personality trait which caused Zeus and other potential suitors to be wary of her. She was the most tremendous talker. A compound of village gossip, nosy neighbour, and over-solicitous best friend, Echo found it impossible to hold her tongue. There was nothing malicious about her prattling. Indeed, she often went out of her way to speak up for her friends, to cover for them, praise them, and paint them in the best light. There was an element of vanity here, for she had a lovely voice, pretty in both speech and song. Like many people gifted with a mellifluous tongue, she loved to exercise it. She was protected, to some extent, by the goddess Aphrodite, who admired her singing, which was always in praise of love. In short, Echo was a romantic. Her detractors might call her sentimental, and even slushy, mushy, and gushy, but they could not deny her good intentions and fullness of heart. Zeus enjoyed visiting Echo's sister Oreads and cousin Naiads in secret, and Echo enjoyed being a confidant and best friend to them all. It rather thrilled her to think that her relations and companions were having liaisons with Zeus, the cloud-gatherer and king of the gods himself. It was a secret she loved to hug to herself. Hera had always been suspicious of Zeus's absences, but recently they had become prolonged. She heard from a chaffinch, loyal to her, that it was the lower slopes of Helicon that her husband had been visiting, so she decided one golden afternoon to make her way there and see if she could catch him in the act of betrayal. She had barely dismounted from her chariot when a mountain nymph skipped up to her, bubbling with inconsequential chatter. It was Echo in full, voluble flow. "Queen Hera!" Hera drew up her eyebrows. "Do I know you?" "Oh, Majesty," cried Echo, falling to her knees. "How lucky we are to see you here! What honour you do us! And in your chariot, too! Is it permitted to feed the peacocks, to have a god of Olympus here? I cannot remember the last time an Olympian deigned to take notice of us. It is such... Surely my husband Zeus is a regular visitor to these woods and waters." Echo knew full well that Zeus was not far away on a river bank doing improper things with a pretty river nymph. Her love of intrigue, drama, and romance now drove her to protect the pair. With tumbling torrents of inconsequential babble gushing from her like water from a fountain, she guided the goddess's footsteps in the direction away from the river bank. "There is a very fine ilex tree just in this clearing, Majesty, which I was thinking of consecrating to you, with your permission. Excuse me? Zeus? Oh, no, I've never seen him here." "Really?" Hera fixed Echo with a hard stare. "I heard a rumour that he was here now, this very day." "No, no, my queen, no, no, no. In fact, a servant of the Muses came down from Helicon just half an hour ago to draw water from our stream, and he mentioned specifically that today mighty Zeus is in Thespiae, honouring his temple there."
"Oh, I see. Well, I thank you."
Hera nodded curtly and uncomfortably, returned to her chariot, and flew off into the clouds. It is mortifying to be witnessed trying to catch your husband out. Echo skipped away, pleased to have been useful to her fellow nymph and to Zeus. In all fairness, she would have been just as happy to have been protecting a mortal pair of lovers. It delighted her to ease the path of all lovers everywhere. She had never really felt love herself, except the love of helping others to love, which she felt was the highest love of all. So selfless was she that she never even bothered to tell Zeus or her sister of her useful act, which someone hoping for a reward would most certainly have done. She sang as she gathered flowers and felt that the life of a nymph was a good life. Echolalia. The next day, back on Olympus, Hera had sent for the chaffinch that had first whispered to her of Zeus's infidelity.
"You lied to me!" she shrieked. "You made me look a fool!"
Hera grasped the bird by the beak so that he could hardly breathe, and was about to punish him in some strange and dreadful way that would forever have altered our conception of chaffinches, when his mate fluttered about her ears and hair, bravely calling out,
"But, dread queen, he told you true. I saw King Zeus there myself. Even as you were talking to that nymph, Echo, he was lying with a naiad not half a mile away. If you don't believe me, the butterflies and herons can tell you. Ask the priestesses at the Temple of Thespiae when he last visited them. He has not been there for 3 moons.
Hera relaxed her grip, and the bird, who had gone almost scarlet, breathed again. Male chaffinches sport pink breasts to this very day. Echo was paddling playfully in a stream when Hera and her peacock carriage descended once more.
The nymph splashed and skipped her way up the riverbank to greet the goddess, a wide and welcoming grin splitting her perfectly dimpled features. The smile of welcome quickly turned to a rounded O of fear when she saw the look of rage on Hera's face. "So," said the goddess with icy calm, "you say my husband has not been here. You say he was not here yesterday. You say he was in Thespiae, sanctifying a temple?" That's certainly my understanding," stammered a frightened echo. "You foolish, gossiping, chattering, scheming liar! How dare you try to deceive the Queen of Heaven? Who do you think you are?"
I...
For once in her life, Echo could think of nothing to say. "Well may you stutter and stammer. You love the sound of your voice, don't you? Hear this." Hera drew herself up and raised her arms high. Her eyes seemed to shine with a purple light. Echo quailed before the grandeur of the sight and wished the ground could swallow her up. "I command your wicked, lying powers of speech to be still. From this moment you will be mute unless spoken to. You will have no power to reply except to repeat the last thing that has been said to you. None can undo this curse. Only I can. Understand?"
"I can understand," cried Echo.
"That's what happens when you disobey the gods."
"Obey the gods?"
"I do not forgive. No mercy."
"Give no mercy."
With a snort and sneer of triumph, Hera whisked herself away, leaving the unhappy nymph shivering in fear and frustration. No matter how much she tried to speak, no words would come. Her throat seemed to catch and tighten every time. One of her sisters came upon her, wordlessly retching and spluttering.
"Hello, Echo. What are you doing?"
"What are you doing?" said Echo. "I asked first.
I asked first."
"No, I did. No, I did."
"Well, if you're going to be like that, go to hell. Go to hell," Echo cried after her, wild with misery.
One by one, all her friends and all her family shunned her. The curse inflicted upon one who had lived her life for gleeful gossip, who valued nothing above cheerful chatter, and who had derived all her pleasure from prattling repartee, was so terrible that Echo now wished for nothing more than to be left alone to welter in silent agony. Echo and Narcissus. Into the painful solitude of Echo's private hell, there crashed one day all the laughter, shouting, and boisterous clamour of a hunt. The youth of Thespiae had chased a boar all the way into the wood, and one of the huntsmen had become separated. He was a youth of such transcendent beauty that Echo, whom the tender passion had passed over all her life, was instantly love-struck. The youth was Narcissus, now older and more dazzling than ever. He had never fallen victim to the tender passion either. He had become so used to girls and boys, men and women, fauns and satyrs, nymphs and dryads, oreads and centaurs, and all manner of beings, sentient and non-sentient, shrieking and sighing and fainting away in his presence, that he thought the whole business of love absurd. It turned sensible people stupid. Narcissus hated being mooned and swooned over. It maddened him to see the unmistakable look of love leaping into the eyes of others. There was something so angry and ugly about that look, something so hungry, lost and despairing, so brooding, haunted and unhappy. To Narcissus, love and desire were sicknesses. He had been taught that lesson in the worst way possible a year ago when a boy called Amenias had declared his love to him. Narcissus had replied, as kindly as he could, that he did not return his love. But Amenias would not take no for an answer and took to haunting Narcissus's every step. He joined him on his morning walk to school, tagging along and gazing at him like a lost and adoring puppy, until Narcissus could stand it no longer and yelled at him to go away and never come near him again. That night, Narcissus had been awoken by a strange sound outside his bedroom. He looked out of his window and saw in the moonlight Amenias hanging from a pear tree, a rope around his neck. He choked out a curse before he died. "May you be as unlucky in love as I have been, beautiful Narcissus." Amenias, according to some sources, became a sweet-smelling herb, possibly dill, perhaps cumin, maybe anise. Since then, Narcissus had got into the habit of keeping his head down, covering his body as much as possible, and being short and gruff to strangers, never meeting them in the eye. But now, as he looked about him, he saw that the rest of the hunting party had gone, and that he was splendidly alone. He decided to take advantage of the cool waters of the stream and its inviting mossy banks. He slipped out of his clothes and plunged into the water. As soon as she caught sight of that lissome and golden form, half sunlit, half dappled by the shade, and all streaming with water, Echo caught her breath. And when, peeping through the leaves, she saw the face, the beautiful, beautiful face of Narcissus, she could no longer control her senses. Were it not for Hera's curse, she would have cried out there and then. Instead, she gazed in silent wonder as the naked youth laid his bow and arrows on the grass and stretched himself out to sleep. When love comes late, it comes like a tornado. Poor Echo's whole being was swept up by her feelings for this impossibly beautiful youth. Nothing, not even the horror of Hera's curse, had ever caused her heart to hammer so violently inside her. The blood pounded and surged in her ears. It was as if she was swirling in the center of a great cyclone. She simply had to take a closer look at this lovely youth. If she felt such tumultuous passions swirling inside her at the sight of him, then perhaps it was in the nature of things that he would feel the same at the sight of her. Surely that must be so. She crept forward, hardly daring to breathe. With each step, she found herself more and more thrilled, until she was quivering and trembling all over with excitement. The stories of love at first sight that she had heard sung all her life were true, after all. This beautiful boy would be bound to return her love. Cosmos and creation would not make sense otherwise. Of course, you and I know that cosmos and creation make no sense at all and never have. Poor Echo was about to discover the truth of this. Whether it was her pounding heart or the cry of a bird, something made the sleeping Narcissus open his eyes just as Echo drew near.
His eyes met hers. Echo was a pretty nymph, lovely, in fact. It was only her eyes that Narcissus saw. That look again, that haggard, hungry, haunted look, those needing, pleading eyes. Ugh! "Who are you?" he said, turning away.
"Who are you?"
"Never you mind. That's my business. That's my business." "No, it isn't. You woke me. You woke me. I suppose, like all the others, you've fallen in love with me."
"Love with me?"
"Love. I'm fed up with love.
Up with love.
It'll never happen. Never. Go away."
"Never go away."
"I don't care how much you wail at me. I hate the sight of you."
"The sight of you."
"Stop it, will you? Just don't," cried Narcissus. "Go away.
Don't go away."
"You're driving me crazy.
Driving me crazy.
Go away before I do something so desperate.
So desperate.
Don't tempt me now.
Tempt me now."
Narcissus picked up his hunting sling and loaded it with a stone. "Go. Just go. I'll hurt you if you don't. Understand?"
"You don't understand."
The first stone missed her, but Echo turned and fled before Narcissus could reload and try again. As she ran, he called out after her, "And never come back."
"Never come back," she cried.
She ran from him and kept running until she fell weeping to the ground, her heart bursting with grief and shame. The Boy in the Water. Narcissus watched her go. He shook his head angrily. Would he never be free of these silly, wailing people and their whining, clutching madness? Love and beauty. Words, just words. Hot and thirsty from all the stress and drama, he knelt down to drink from the stream. He caught his breath in astonishment when in its waters he saw the loveliest face he had ever laid eyes upon, the sweet and surprised face of a most beautiful young man. He had golden hair and soft red lips. Narcissus recognized with a thrill that the youth's beguiling and loving eyes had the hungry, needy look he had always found so repellent in others. But the very same expression on the gorgeous face of this mysterious stranger made Narcissus' chest swell and heart thump with joy. It must mean that the glorious creature in the river felt the same way as he did. Narcissus leant down to kiss the lovely lips, and the lovely lips came up to kiss his. But just as Narcissus lowered his face, the stranger's face broke into a thousand dancing, rippling pieces until he could see it no longer, and Narcissus found he was kissing nothing but cold water.
"Stay still, lovely one," he breathed,
and the boy seemed to whisper the same to him. Narcissus raised a hand. The boy raised his hand in reply. Narcissus wanted to stroke the boy's lovely cheek, and the boy wanted to do the same. But the face fractured and dissolved the moment Narcissus got close. Again and again each one tried. Meanwhile, in the bushes behind them, Echo, fired and strengthened by her great love, had returned to try her luck again. Her heart skipped a beat when she heard him say, "I love you."
"I love you," she called back. "Stay with me. Stay with me. Never leave me. Never leave me."
But when she came closer, Narcissus turned with a snarl and hissed at her, "Go away! Leave us alone! Never come back! Never! Never! Never!"
"Never! Never! Never!"
wailed Echo. With a savage roar, Narcissus picked up a stone and hurled it at her. Echo ran and tripped. Narcissus picked up his bow and would surely have shot her dead had she not scrambled to her feet and disappeared into the wood. Narcissus looked anxiously back to the stream, frightened that perhaps the marvellous boy had gone. But there he was, a worried and flushed look on his face, but as beautiful and loving as ever, and with a wonderful gleam in his deep blue eyes. Narcissus lay down again and brought his face closer to the water. The gods take pity. Echo ran and ran up the hillside, sobbing with grief and desolation. She hid in a cave high above the river by whose banks the lovely Narcissus lay. Inside her head, Echo framed the words of a prayer to her favourite goddess, Aphrodite. In mute despair, she begged to be relieved of the pain of love and the intolerable burden of her cursed existence. Aphrodite answered the nymph's prayers as best she could. She freed the nymph of her body and most of her physical self. She did not have the power to lift Hera's curse, so the voice remained. The voice that had got Echo into all that trouble in the first place. The voice that was doomed to repeat and repeat. Nothing more was left of the once beautiful nymph, just the answering voice. You can hear Echo still, returning your last few words when you call out near caves, canyons, cliffs, hills, streets, squares, temples, monuments, ruins and empty rooms. And Narcissus? Day after day he lay by the river, passionately and hopelessly in love with his own reflection, gazing at himself, filled with love for himself and longing for himself, with eyes only for himself and consideration for no one and nothing but himself. He drooped down over the water, pining and pining, until at last the gods turned him into the delicate and beautiful daffodil that bears his name, and whose lovely head always bows down to look at itself in puddles, pools, and streams. You can choose to think of the characteristics these doomed young people have bequeathed us and our language as standard human traits or as problematic afflictions. Narcissistic personality disorder and echolalia, the apparently mindless repetition of what is said, are both classified in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that medically and legally defines mental illnesses. Narcissistic personality disorder, much talked about these days, is marked by vanity, self-importance, a grandiose hunger for admiration, acclaim and applause, and above all, an obsession with the self-image. The feelings of others are railroaded and stampeded, while such considerations as honesty, truthfulness or integrity are blithely disregarded. Bragging, boasting, and delusional exaggeration are common signs. Criticism or belittlement is intolerable and can provoke aggressive and explosively strange behaviours. No one we know, of course. Perhaps narcissism is best defined as a need to look on other people as mirrored surfaces, who satisfy us only when they reflect back a loving or admiring image of ourselves. When we look into another's eyes, in other words, we are not looking to see who they are, but how we are reflected
in their eyes. By this definition, which of us can honestly disown our share of narcissism? Lovers. Tristan and Isolde, Romeo and Juliet, Heathcliff and Catherine, Sue Ellen and J.R., Kanye and Kim, the doomed lovers we know, all owe a great debt to the tragic Greek tradition that preceded them. Pyramus and Thisbe. When we hear the name Babylon, we think of a Middle Eastern civilization famed for ribaldry and excess. Its hanging gardens were one of the original seven wonders of the world, and for a time, Babylon was the largest city in the world. The remains of the city lie under the sand of Iraq, about 50 miles south of Baghdad. The Babylonian Empire took in much of Asia Minor. Indeed, some believe that this story really took place in Cilicia, the kingdom that Cilix founded before he joined Cadmus and the other sons of Agenor in their quest for Europa. Ovid, however, is happy to locate the action plumb in the centre of Babylon, and that is where I have placed it, too. In Babylon, then, lived two families who had been feuding, no one quite remembers why, for generations. Their great palaces stood next to each other on the main street of the city, but the children of each household were raised as enemies, forbidden so much as to speak, write, or sign to one another. One of the families had a son called Pyramus, and the other a daughter called Thisbe, who somehow fell in love with each other despite the obstacles in their way. They had discovered a small hole in a shared wall between their adjoining homes. Through this aperture they whispered, swapping views of life, poetry and music, until they found themselves falling very deeply in love. The hole in the wall was too small to allow them to touch, but the heat of their young and ardent passion could be breathed from one mouth to another through that benevolent chink, intensified by the forbidden nature of their feelings and their thrillingly unbridgeable proximity. This exchange of hot, youthful breath inflamed them so much that one night, maddened beyond endurance, they arranged each to escape their respective palaces and meet at night in the grounds of the tomb of Pyramus's ancestor, the Assyrian king Ninus, founder of the great city of Nineveh. And so, the following evening, the nimble and quick-witted Thisbe slips the guardians of her room and the sentries on duty outside her father's palace, and is soon beyond the city walls, built all those years ago by her ancestor, Queen Semiramis. When she reaches the trysting place, Thisbe encounters not her lover, Pyramus, but a savage lion, whose jaws drip with the blood of its recent prey, an ox. Frightened by its roars, Thisbe runs from the cemetery. In the hurry and panic of her flight, she drops her veil. The lion approaches the veil, snuffles it, takes it between its jaws and shakes it from side to side, staining it with some of the ox blood on its muzzle before letting it fall back to the ground, giving one last roar and padding off into the night. A little later, Pyramus arrives on the scene and sets himself to wait for his beloved under a tall mulberry tree loaded with its heavy summer burden of snow-white fruit. A shaft of moonlight shoots between the tree's branches and illuminates Thisbe's veil, which is lying on the ground, all smeared and dabbled with gore. Pyramus snatches it up. Horror-struck, he can make out the embroidered crest of Thisbe's family in the blood-stained linen, and more than that, he recognizes the scent of the girl with whom he has exchanged the fierce fever of love's breath so many times. Paw prints on the ground bear witness to the presence of a lion. Blood
Paw prints, the family crest, the unmistakable scent of Thisbe herself, the clear and tragic meaning of it all bursts in on Pyramus. With a cry of despair, he draws his sword and stabs himself deep in the stomach, ripping the wound wider from side to side in his hurry to join his dead beloved. Blood spurts up from him like a fountain, dyeing the white mulberries purple. "You took the beloved Thisbe away before we could be united for the short span of our lives," Pyramus cries to the heavens. "So let us be one in the endless night of eternal death." With these noble words, he expires upon the ground. In the farcical production in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Pyramus, played by Bottom, cries out as he stabs himself, "Thus die I, thus, thus, thus. Now I am dead, now I am fled. My soul is in the sky. Tongue, lose thy light. Moon, take thy flight. Now die, 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 die." Enter Thisbe. In the dead hands of Pyramus, she sees her own veil, smeared and spattered with blood. She sees the lion paw prints and reads all too clearly the story written there. "Oh, gods, can you have been so jealous of our love that you could not grant us even one short moment of happiness?" she cries. She sees Pyramus's sword pointing up to the stars. It is still hot and wet with his blood. She throws herself upon it, plunging it deep into her belly with a cry of triumph and ecstasy in one of the most Freudian suicides ever. When the two families are taken to the site of the tragedy, they fall weeping on each other's necks and beg forgiveness. The feud is over. The lovers' bodies are cremated and their ashes mixed together in a single urn. As for their spirits, well, Pyramus was turned into the river that bore his name for millennia, and Thisbe into a spring whose waters run into it. The flow of the Pyramus, now called the Seihan, has been dammed for hydroelectric energy, so the power of the two lovers now goes to light Turkish homes. In honour of their love and sacrifice, the gods decreed that the mulberry fruit will from that moment on be always a deep crimson purple, the colour of passion and blood. Galateas. Acis and Galatea. Galatea, the milk-white Nereid, a daughter of Doris and Nereus, was adored by Polyphemus the Cyclops. Not one of the original Cyclopes, Polyphemus was the savage and ugly offspring of Poseidon and the Oceanid Thusa. Galatea herself loved Acis, a Sicilian shepherd boy of simple charm and beauty. Though the son of the river nymph Smathis and the god Pan, Acis was only mortal. The jealous Polyphemus caught sight of Acis and Galatea in each other's arms and hurled a boulder down onto the boy, crushing and killing him. The grieving Galatea was able to call upon sufficient power and resources, or perhaps had enough friends on Olympus, to be able to turn Acis into an immortal river spirit, with whom she consorts for eternity. Their story is the subject of Handel's pastoral opera, Acis and Galatea. Galatea 2. While on the subject of girls called Galatea, which means milk-white, there are two more worth meeting. Pandion of Phaistos in Crete had a son, Lampros, who married a Galatea.
Pandion had no interest in fathering girl children, and told his wife that if she gave birth to a daughter, she was to kill it and keep trying until she bore the son he craved. Their first child was a beautiful baby girl. Galatea did not have the heart to kill her, what mother would, and told her husband that the baby had been born a healthy boy, and that she wanted to call him Leucippos, meaning white horse. Pandion took his wife at her word, without bothering with any anatomical inspections, and thus, raised male, Leucippos grew up to be a fine, intelligent, universally liked and accepted boy. Teenage years approached, however, and Galatea became more and more afraid that her beloved child's lush natural curves and striking lack of any downy growth on the chin must eventually give the game away to Pandion, who was not the kind of man to overlook such a deception. For safety's sake, Galatea took Leucippos and sought refuge in a temple of Leto, the Titaness mother of Apollo and Artemis, where she prayed that her daughter might change her sex. Leto answered the prayer, and on the instant Leucippos was transformed into a masculine youth. Hairs pushed through where they should on a male, the correct bulges appeared, the incorrect bulges disappeared. Pandion was none the wiser, and they all lived happily ever after. For generations after this, the city of Phaistos celebrated a festival they called the Ecdousia, a word that covers molting, shedding, casting off and re-evaluating, slipping out of one thing and popping on another. In this ritual, all young Phaistian boys lived among women and girls, wore female clothes, and had to swear an oath of citizenship before they could graduate from their agilar or youth corps and acquire full male dress and status. For more on this fascinating subject, see The Perils of Leucippos, Initiatory Transvesticism and Male Gender Ideology in the Ecdousia at Phaistos by David Leitao, University of California Press, 1995. Leucippos II, Daphne and Apollo. Interestingly, another myth tells of a different sex-changing Leucippos, this one a son of Oenomaus, who fell in love with the naiad Daphne, whom Apollo also loved, but had not so far wooed or seduced. In order to be near Daphne, Leucippos II disguised himself as a girl and joined her company of nymphs. The jealous Apollo saw this and caused the reeds to whisper to Daphne that she and her attendants should bathe in the river. Accordingly, they slipped out of their clothes and splashed about naked. When Leucippos, for obvious reasons, refused to remove his maidenly garb, the girls teasingly stripped him bare, discovered his embarrassing and unmistakable secret, and angrily speared him to death. By this time, Apollo's own lustful blood was up. He materialized and began a pursuit of Daphne. The terrified girl leapt out of the river and ran away as fast as she could, but he gained on her. He had almost reached her when she sent up a prayer to Gaia and her father, the river god Ladon. Just as Apollo closed in and touched her, he felt her flesh change under his fingers. A thin bark formed over her breasts. Her hair began to slither out into shining yellow and green leaves. Her limbs wreathed themselves into branches, and her feet slowly drove down roots into her mother Gaia's receiving earth. A stupefied Apollo found that he was clutching not a naiad, but a laurel tree. For once in his life, the god was chastened. The laurel became sacred to him, and its wreath thenceforward crowned the brow, as I have said, of the winners of his Pythian games at Delphi.
to this day, the winner of a great prize is still called a laureate. Daphne should not be confused with Daphnis, a Sicilian youth of great beauty who was found as a baby under the laurel bush that gave him his name. Both Hermes and Pan fell in love with him, the latter teaching him to play the pipes. He became so proficient that later generations credited him with the invention of pastoral poetry. In the 2nd century AD, Longus, a writer from Lesbos, wrote a romance, like The Golden Ass, a contender for the title First Ever Novel, called Daphnis and Chloe, which tells of two bucolic lovers who undergo all kinds of ordeals and adventures to test their love. Offenbach wrote an operetta based on this tale. Even better known is the revolutionary 1912 ballet, with music by Maurice Ravel, choreographed by Fokine and danced by Nijinsky. Galatea 3, and Pygmalion too. The Isle of Cyprus, being the landing ground of spume-born Aphrodite, had long worshipped the goddess of love and beauty with a special fervour, earning Cypriots a reputation for libertine licentiousness and libidinous loose living. Cyprus was thought of by the mainland as a degenerate place, an island of free love. One group of women, the daughters of Propita,